We are joined now by an actual World Bank staffer. Mr. Cartman, are you there?
Yig-hi!
Hello, excuse me, Mr. Cartman.
Do you hear something? I think I hear the flower children calling.
Yes, that would be the thousands of people converging on D.C. to protest your organization. What do you think about that, Mr. Cartman?
Who cares? It's all a bunch of tree-hugging hippie crap.
Mr. Cartman, if we could please stay focused here. A lot of people are in town because they claim that your organization is keeping the third world in poverty.
Why do poor people always smell like sour milk?
Mr. Cartman, please let me continue. The mission of your organization is supposedly to eliminate poverty, to help feed people.
I'm not bringing in food for poor people. Screw them.
Please, let me finish. Mr. Cartman, can you deny that the countries that you're supposedly helping out, like, are in absolute poverty, like in Central America, in Africa?
My mom says there's a lot of black people in Africa.
You're completely ignoring the question here, and that is, you know, what do you have to say about the global poverty that your organization is causing on the rest of the world? What can you say to these people that you're keeping in poverty?
Poor people tend to live in clusters. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can see we're going absolutely no place with this. Let's discuss for a moment the huge march on the Capitol this week, supported by the AFL-CIO and a whole bunch of other unions, on normalizing trade relations with China. What do you think about that?
My mom says there's a lot of black people in China.
Okay, Mr. Cartman, I can see this is going nowhere. End of interview. Do you have anything to say to the people that are going to be protesting you tomorrow?
Yeah, hippie. Go back to Woodstock.
Hey, I'm not going to sit here and take this abuse from you.
Respect my authority!
Oh, yeah? What if I don't?
Hey, I'll blow your freaking head off!
Okay. Mr. Cartman, thank you for coming. We'll see you tomorrow.
Screw you, hippie! And stop your bitching!
Derisive accounts in the mainstream press have described the protesters as rebels without a cause. Nothing could be further from the truth. The movement that burst into mainstream consciousness with the battle in Seattle has been building throughout the 90s and, in addition to engaging in protest against the existing order, its participants are actively implementing direct democracy, non-hierarchical social structures, and consensus decision-making. We spoke with Matthew Schmucker, an environmental activist and a veteran of the Minnehaha Free State, a 16-month blockade action which took place in Minnesota, about the process and philosophy behind the actions.
Let me just say that there are many, many people involved in this mobilization who all have very unique histories of how they've become aware of various issues that they're focusing on. There are people focusing on organizing their workplace, on labor issues, people focusing on anti-privatization of things like health care, access to health care, privatization of prisons. There are people focusing on ecological issues and feminist issues. Everyone has their unique story about how they've realized that we all have common enemies in this struggle and a common vision. You know, we have common enemies, and that is the global financial institutions that are totally undemocratic, that are making the decisions that degrade our local economies, cultures, and ecosystems on behalf of transnational corporations. And we have a common vision that we fundamentally believe that our communities and the communities around the world are more qualified to make the decisions that affect us directly. And, you know, I've been involved in a lot of environmental issues for some time now. And basic issues of community autonomy. I was in Minnehaha for the full 16-month occupation to stop the rerouting of Highway 55 going through a working-class neighborhood, through sacred sites to the Mendota, Metawakaton, Dakota people, and environmentally valuable sites in a city park. And it has a lot in common with this struggle. They're all connected, really. What we had there was a highway reroute to save 2.5 minutes driving time between the Mall of America and the downtown shopping area that everyone was virtually unanimously opposed to, except the corporations. And so you had government acting on behalf of corporations. The IMF and the World Bank go around the world and essentially favor working with corrupt governments and dictatorships, and they put out loans to to countries, or to governments, let me say, into financial interests that essentially build things like highways, build things like power plants, basically building a corporate infrastructure so that they can effectively channel or extract the wealth of these countries, whether it be natural resources, labor resources, what have you, out of the country to effectively have the global south subsidize a corporate elite. And then when it comes time to repay these debts, it's the poor, it's the people who have to tighten their belts. They have to close a hospital here or have hospitals privatized or their wage level lowered in order to attract foreign capital, foreign business, not foreign capital, the foreign the capital is going from their country to others, but to attract foreign investment, transnational corporations. And investment's a bad word, too. They're investing for themselves. They're not investing in the country. So it's very similar in that here we have the Minnesota Department of Transportation clearly making their policies based on corporate interests instead of the interests of the people and the communities that are directly affected. But it's the taxpayers that have to pay for it. It's the people. So we have a real lack of democracy everywhere you go. There's a growing sense in the United States, it's been a sense all over the world, that fundamentally we're not in control of the decisions that affect our communities. And we want to take that power back. And so, I was involved in Minnehaha for a long time. Now I'm involved in this, and they're not separate. First of all, there was a 40-year struggle through the legal process to stop this highway. Community struggle. Well, finally, the Minnesota Department of Transportation gained eminent domain over the houses, evicted everyone, and got their way. So Carol Kratz, the last, and Al Kratz, the last remaining resident, 67-year-old couple, invited Earth First to use direct action and occupy the homes that were slated for destruction on August 10th, 1998. And so they built it. Then by us taking on a struggle that is valuable to a community, we were able to raise the consciousness of environmental issues. And by the American Indian Movement and the Mendota doing the same thing, they were able to raise the consciousness about indigenous issues. And we formed a very powerful coalition based on mutual respect of each other's groups and each other's tactics and sensitivity in our language and in our what tactics we use toward each other and toward the community. And we were able to walk this whole community along and radicalize it very much in its overarching view of how democratic the society actually is and about issues of corporate dominance over our lives. There were many ends. There was the campaign and there was the encampment. And they're not separate, but they are somewhat. And it was amazing. We base things on consensus. Decision-making power is based on consensus rather than majority rules or dictatorship.
Consensus is kind of an elaborate process. How did you educate people in that? Did you come up with special ways to do it? Did they have anything to do with the cultures and histories of the different people you had in this action?
Well, some of the groups didn't run by consensus. Some of the Earth First ran by consensus, and the encampment ran by consensus. Some of the different groups didn't run by consensus. The coalition didn't at first. Later on, it did. And basically, we want to organize in a way that gives each group involved the autonomy to make their decisions by whatever way they need to, as long as they're respectful of the broader coalition. And so, just like at this, the affinity group structure we have here, it's up to a group whether they want to pre-plan their action for their affinity group. But the overarching structure is one of consensus. We decided on this because essentially it's empowering the people. No one wants a dictator. No one likes to be dictated to. People want to maintain their creative autonomy. So, it worked in many ways. Sometimes it's long and drawn out. Sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes meetings take longer than they would in a majority rules or in a dictatorship. But in the long run, we're stronger because we're all behind all of the decisions we make. One person can block a decision. We do this, we arrange ourselves like this very intentionally, like here in D.C., this mobilization, our structure, the affinity group structure of consensus, we arrange ourselves in this way because it's very democratic and it stands in stark contrast to the global financial institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, that we're opposing. They meet in secret, they're exclusive, they're not allowing the press in, they're totally undemocratic, unelected. Nobody votes for the IMF or the World Bank to make the policy changes that affect their country or that affect us in the United States indirectly because of the economic conditions they've created throughout the world.
There are people who believe that the present way that decisions are made and things are carried out is the only type of decision making that could possibly deal with such a complex social structure. And what I have seen here are, you know, enormously complex things and thousands of people being fed, housed, taught. What would you have to say to people who say, oh, no, well, you know, this type of thing just couldn't work on a day-to-day basis in society?
Well, it is working. We're doing it here. It's been done all over the place. This is not new. Indigenous people have governed themselves for millions of years. You know, other societies have governed themselves. There has not been big government or global financial institutions before. They're a very new phenomenon if you look in the whole scheme of things. And people don't like it. You know, we're not saying that you can run the government of the United States or the World Bank or the IMF or the WTO by consensus. You can't. It's too big. It would require huge representation, and it's really a logistic impossibility. So really you have fake democracy. What we're saying is smaller is better. We want our communities to be essentially in control of their own destiny. We want us to be able to make our decisions, decide. We're not saying we can't trade. We're saying our community will decide whether we want to trade, whether it's advantageous, whether it's worth the energy, whether it's efficient for our needs. Those decisions will be up to us instead of up to transnational corporations or anyone who's out for profit instead of for the interests of the particular community, whether it be urban, rural, whether it be in the United States or around the world.
What happens in a consensus democracy when you have people behaving in an antisocial manner, for lack of a better description?
We try to work with everyone, even people who are disruptive, and try to bring everyone into the fold. This is a people's movement to take back basic decision-making power for our communities from transnational corporations and everyone else who's robbed it. And we value everyone who's part of this movement. People are not expendable. People are only expendable to big governments and to transnational corporations. Here we value people. There are problems sometimes. Part of the consensus process is you've got to basically agree to the basic tenets that brought the group together. If you don't agree to those, then you really got to find another group or another community or another, and, you know, in most cases, and, you know, in organizing things like this, those things are decided by the individual. They can realize and get the hint that their vision is not compatible with that of, you know, the larger group of. You know, in consensus, you have blocks. Those are used very rarely. You block if you think a decision is totally against the basic tenets of the group. If you're using lots of blocks, well, you need to find another group because obviously your vision doesn't meet up with that of the group's. And usually, but I mean, sometimes it needs to be done by the group. The group needs to decide this person. Those situations are rare, and we try to avoid them. You know, at all costs, we try to keep everyone on the same page.
Did you ever personally have to deal with a situation like that? And I'm interested in, like, how did you feel and, you know, what did you do? Or what did other people do that you're aware of? I mean, you don't have to mention the specifics of,
right,
you know, who did what to whom, but...
Well, I mean, what we try to do is, you know, there's disruptive behavior. It happens sometimes naturally. It happens sometimes intentionally by outside forces. We address people's behavior. We talk about it as a group. The consensus process, rather than majority rules or a leadership structure, is much less vulnerable to people who have their own agenda that's not in particularly in with the group, because there's no way that they can get into a position of power where they can dictate to the group what to do. We won't be ruled here. We have rotating positions. People who talk to the media and rotate, people who do become a spokes or facilitate a meeting, things like that, but it's all rotating, and no one's going to tolerate anything being dictated to them. So mostly it's really not a problem.
We're taught how to behave in certain situations that are part of the mainstream society, and we have certain skills. And then, you know, you come into a situation like this where there are new skills. I mean, for example, the skill of facilitation. I mean, I don't think people are born knowing how to do this, and I think you can do it well and not do it well. How do people learn these skills as they're coming into this new society here and being a part of it?
Well, right here, this week, this Convergence Week, it started on the 8th and is going until Saturday the 15th. People from all over the country with knowledge about particular issues, from particular regions, with particular skills are coming here to share those skills with each other in a very empowering way, in a participatory way. We don't have like people who teach and everyone else is quiet. It's an interactive thing. And that's how people learn. That's how we're exchanging ideas. One thing we're not doing, I think one thing we've learned a lot or are learning from the movement in the 60s is we're not trying to homogenize people into one set way of doing things. The affinity structure is set up so that we can have collective expressions like this of our discontent from our particular communities, and communities can come into this and maintain their autonomy in the part of the action that they plan. The real work isn't these things. These are big expressions of that. The real work is in our communities having awareness grow about, you know, having people articulate their frustrations in the society and realize who the enemies are and what we can do about it. So what we're doing is we're structuring ourselves so that people don't have to homogenize. You know, in the movements, social movements in this country in the late 60s and early 70s, in reaction to a mass corporate culture, a homogenized culture, there was a counterculture that was built, which was also cultural homogenization. It might have been a million times better than the corporate culture. Sometimes we call it anti-culture because it destroys other cultures, but it was still cultural homogenization. And I think a lot of people here are conscious that we don't want cultural homogenization. We want to identify more with our communities. We want this to be a movement for and by diverse cultures and diverse communities, so that, you know, it's a structure where we can all work together, but we don't have to conform. And we're strong in that diversity. And people can't look at us on television or in the media and say, that's one kind of people. It's many different kinds of people. And there's pretty much someone that anyone can identify with, excluding those who are in power. Pretty much anyone can relate to this movement who's not in power. It's a people's movement to take back basic power on a smaller level.
Okay, so what I hear you saying is that rather than setting up once again a new culture, well, I mean, there's a bit of it, I guess, but a new culture in opposition to corporate culture, it's carving out the space for people to deliberately develop or express whatever cultures it is that they want without the imposition from the top?
Yeah, it's not like a counterculture. It's a pro-culture movement, culture in general, you know, diverse culture. We want diversity back. We want to, you know, participate in forming our own cultures, and you can only do that on a smaller level, I think people are finding. We want to make our own music, make our own art. We want to, you know, sing songs that we've written, not have things trickle down to the radio and have everywhere you go in the United States, you don't, or in the world, you don't even know where you are anymore. It's, you know, the same chain stores, the same songs on the radio. This is an unprecedented movement. There has never been a global movement like this. And, you know, it's everywhere, and everyone who's not in power can participate. And it's not a movement, like I said, for anyone to seize control of these institutions. Essentially, it's to abolish these institutions. And, you know, there are people throughout this coalition, there are some people who focus on particularly on the debt issue. And, you know, it's they've had far long, you know these countries have repaid the initial sum over and over again. They're destitute. It's time to cancel this debt, and that's an admirable cause. There are other people who are abolitionists of this, you know, these institutions. Over 50 years is way more than enough for these institutions to prove their ability to alleviate power, which is their said goal. And there are people who want to abolish capitalism all out and want to abolish, you know, any structures that rob us of our community power. There's diverse critiques, and we're not trying to come up with one big critique for the movement. We're strong in that diversity. And we allow room for each other, and we're sensitive to each other. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out, and what kind of resistance we meet and come against. You know, Seattle is using tear gas and pepper spray, and rubber bullets and concussion grenades, you know, that those pepper spray is torture, and it's totally inappropriate to use against nonviolent people. And this is symptomatic of how the IMF and the World Bank have favored working with corrupt dictatorships all around the world, countries that, whose governments can suppress any popular opposition to their policies. And now we're seeing an anti-corporate globalization movement in this country as well. We're joining up with the rest of the world. And in Seattle, we saw that same exact repression. And is this going to be a pattern? Well, we're committed. We're not going to let anything deter us.
Can you talk about love, and can you talk about fear? Whatever you want to say about those things,
well,
how those relate.
I try to stay away from those terms and stuff in general, just because, you know, I'm not convinced that we're particularly good people here, better than anyone else in the world, or that, like, we're acting in love and everyone else is acting in this way. I think that, you know, part of the reason people in the United States are finally joining in this movement is that we've got something at stake now. In the 80s, people were convinced that we were benefiting, the American public at large was benefiting from these policies. Now we're realizing that it's the corporate elite who are benefiting and no one else is, and our lives are going to be getting worse and worse and worse until something changes fundamentally. I don't think that there are, you know, I don't think it's about, like, converting people to act in love so much as changing fundamentally the structures so that you know, I think fundamentally we're all, you know, somewhat good people. We're decent people. We want, you know, we value things like democracy and participation in the decisions that affect us and taking care of our families and our communities and things like that. People everywhere, you know, are in favor of those. And we want structures that allow good people to do good things, not structures. We have structures where very good people, you know, some people who are working for corporations are the most lovable people in the world. They're great people. They're doing horrible things because of the way the system's set up. We want to restructure that.
This is what democracy sounds like. 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 This is what democracy sounds like.
They just pushed down a female protester onto the ground. They're pushing her. They're hitting her. They're hitting her. Pushing into the street. They're pushing into the street with a baton. What's the badge number? Get the badge number.
Yeah. Those people who would decide that they're going to take the law into their own hands in different ways,
right?
Then we have an obligation to suppress that. Only to suppress it. You'll notice that we're not still up there beating them.
IMF, what do you say?
How many kids did you kill today?
IMF,
what do you say?
How many kids did you kill today?
IMF,
what do you say?
How many kids did you kill today?
We blocked off, successfully blocked off, and kept delegates from going into down three entrances into Lafayette Park.
One cluster of the activists with the Mobilization for Global Justice have taken control of the intersection peacefully by locking themselves together.
I'm here because I passionately believe that global capitalism is destroying our planet and it's destroying communities.
People of the South, kick the World Bank out! People of the South, kick the World Bank out! People of the South, kick the World Bank out!
We're here downtown Washington, D.C., asserting some people power, showing that regular people can turn around history.
Deep State planet!
Arthur, and I'm at 18th and I, and there's police barricades. There's a large contingent here in the street. A dumpster has been rolled up against the metal fencing. It's a very confrontational situation. Although the police have yet to put on their gas masks, pepper spray has been used multiple times. So that's what's going on here. It's pretty tense, but it's a sunny day, and revolution is in the air.
Being here all the time, I work in D.C., so being here all the time, you know, you're pretty much inundated with wow, this is America. These all the monuments. This is the center of, you know, the power of the U.S. military-industrial complex. And all day it was anarchists running amok through the streets of D.C., you know. Of course, D.C. doesn't really have a democracy in it or anything, but here we were out in the streets in force, you know, going by the Washington Monument, you know, barricaded outside the White House, running up and down through the heart of like the nation's capital, in the heart of big government, and completely being able to do whatever we wanted. Whatever we wanted. There were no number of government representatives that could stop us from taking the streets, moving stuff around. I mean, it was just really inspiring. Here we are in the Capitol, anarchists, you know, completely outside the law, constantly at an illegal demonstration, and, you know, doing it all together. I'm going to be thinking every time I walk through D.C., I will look at it in a completely different way. I'll no longer think of it as my friend Lynn Blacken likes to say, that the city of death, where, you know, all hope has been crushed and everything is filtered through a corporate media, but rather it's a city that can come back to life whenever it chooses.
Flint Jones is a labor activist with the Industrial Workers of the World. He talked about his experiences at the demonstration on Sunday, marching with the Black Bloc, a cluster of affinity groups of about 1,000 anarchist activists from various cities. Traditionally, Black Blocs, whose participants dress in black to demonstrate their unity, take a role in militant defense during a direct action. In D.C., the Bloc was one of several mobile or flying squads that put themselves between the police and the vulnerable protesters who were seated and locked together at strategic intersections in order to prevent IMF delegates from entering the meeting area.
Black Blockers probably got, when violence came down, they got most of it. It was pretty nonviolent. We didn't get beat up that much by the cops. They could have taken a lot more opportunities to crack heads. When they do pepper gas or any kind of spray or smoke bombs, everybody was really prepared for that. Everybody had their gear together, and those that weren't, you know, knew to get back. The big question was for us all, particularly to the end of the day, that if we're doing the blockades, if we're doing the barricades, in a city like D.C., it's really hard to do. It's really spread out, and quite frankly, I'm impressed with how much of the city we could hold. But to stop one or two people at a time, or even a van load of folks getting to a meeting, really, really hard to do, because they were moving in through restaurants and tunnels and all kinds of stuff. And apparently they started getting them in really, really early, even before some of the blockades were set up. That if a blockade, you know, doesn't work, if a blockade doesn't work, you can't stop people from coming in and out, then all we're doing with the blockades for civil disobedience is not letting our group of protesters, marchers, have full mobility to, like, press release lines and actually get to the location the meeting's happening. If maybe we hadn't had so many barricades last so long, particularly when they weren't being useful, to broken those up and instead decided to march on the bank, I think we could have had enough people that no matter how many cops they had, we would have been able to get inside and disrupt the meeting itself. And I do think that in the future, unless we got special considerations with terrain, those tactics will work some of the time, but not all the time. And we really have to consider looking at more and more occupations to shut down these meetings. That will mean a lot more confrontation with the police. That'll be a lot more than simply, you know, getting to an undefended intersection by the cops and locking down. We'll actually have to go, we'll have to press, we'll have to gain ground, you know, and do it, you know, in a nonviolent fashion, because if we get violent, the cops will just, you know, really break bad on us. But it's going to come to questions like, well, you know, we come into the door of the World Bank. Do we break down the door or not? Does that count as poverty destruction, or is that in the way of us disrupting this meeting? And for symbolic, for spectacle, I mean, it was great spectacle. The way the national media, the corporate media tended to cover it, they could have done a much better job covering the numbers. They always, always underwrote the numbers by amounts we just thought were grotesque. Getting about 20,000 were the numbers that we're looking at, and the media was reporting it sometimes as few as 7,000, which is curious because, you know, by the day they're saying, oh, well, there's much less demonstrators, but they're still doing hit-and-run tactics in the hundreds. So, you know, we had 600 people arrested the night before, and plus all the ellipse, we probably easily had 20,000 people. The Black Bloc alone was probably 1,000 on the move, and that's just the people who are actively part of the Bloc. Not all the anarchists who were locked down, not the anarchists at the Independent Media Center, not the anarchists doing support work, you know, autonomously or feeding people with food, not bombs. And we were here and we were in force. And, you know, we definitely were, you know, an ideology that was very present and people were very aware. A lot of people did a very good job not mobilizing us.
Were you on the IWW part of the blockade?
No, I actually did not get involved with the IWW part of the blockade, which is something else, which is a whole other section of anarchists, and the Anarchist Soccer League were on a whole separate portion of the blockade route. We largely stuck around the north and the east and moved around where there seemed to be a lot of trouble. Though I hear they could have used a lot more support in the south, and maybe if we'd gotten a little bit more tactical. But some cases, it's just a case of firefighting. The demonstrators were largely sitting in the intersection because the police were being pretty menacing. And the black block came around the corner, sort of facing down the police, right? And the cops ended up charging us like three times, you know, occasionally, you know, hitting people and things like that. They ended up charging us three times, and during like part of it, I think the tank was around the corner. A lot of the demonstrators were very concerned, like, that we were provoking the cops to attack us, that there was a real big division there between the people who were wanting to stand up to the cops, you know, and hold the line, and people wanted to sit down to calm them down. Usually through most of the day, the cops were pretty cool, and they didn't charge people and beat up a lot. I mean, some of it happened, but usually it was like, it didn't seem so organized and systematic as it has been in other places. But that line had a lot of hotheads on it. There were a lot of us. And they were getting spooked. And the way they were trying to deal with the spook was, you know, to charge out, lash out with clubs. They weren't trying to arrest anyone at that point. When the cops were charging, everybody was, you know, chanting nonviolence. Mostly the black bloc, you know, stood to ground. Some of us, like, sat down and tried to calm down or backed away. Usually when the cops strike, you know, we got out of the way. But luckily nobody, like, ran and panicked. So they all handled it pretty cool. Three or four people got clubbed pretty bad. So in this case, what happened was they moved up, and I guess they didn't get the reinforcements that they expected, or as many as they wanted. So they basically left that intersection and pulled back about a block, trotting back. All right, when they took off, you know, give us an inch, we'll take a mile. We ended up pushing them probably three blocks back into George Washington University, where the frats and stuff were, into the campus. I don't know how, like, strategic that was, but us pushing them back all the way, some of the people in the back part of the block grabbed all the large university dumpsters that were around and pulled them out into the street. I mean, we had like three or four dumpsters out into the street. People in like the community that were around us, you know, were yelling stuff. They were excited, and they all came out to watch, see what was going on. And, you know, later when we came back for our victory march through that neighborhood, they all opened up their houses and started blaring their stereos, and everybody had a good old party. Once we got the dumpsters set up and we pushed the cops back, then the black bloc pulled back and went back to the next place where they need to go along. That was really well handled. Now those dumpsters are in the way, and those demonstrators that were so concerned about, you know, nonviolence and non-confrontational pops, so that you could confront the cops, you know, nonviolently, just because you're willing to stand up for yourself, you know, and say, here we are, you're not going to move us, that you can actually gain ground. And I think pushing those cops back, you know, helped not only, like, hold that intersection for a while, but also helps show people, you know, other ways to be nonviolent yet confrontational. We don't have to be non-confrontational with the police. This is a confrontational demonstration. We were wanting to confront the World Bank and the IMF. We wanted to stop it.
Not all of the protests took the form of marches and blockades. We spoke with Simple, one of a group of about 100 activists who call themselves the Guerrilla Gardeners, about another way of thinking globally and acting locally.
Can you talk a little bit about the guerrilla gardening action and why gardening? What does that have to do with corporate globalization and international development policies?
The gardening action is the root of a lot of things that are happening in this world. Basically, we are right now all in need of the corporate agribusiness. We are in need of them because that's how they have structured it, and we do not need to be. We can set all the green spaces in our cities, in our towns. We can have these green spaces turned into food, to gardens, for food, for our communities, and we can sustain ourselves. This is something that can happen, even though they tell us all the time that we won't be able to do it. There's too many. It can be done. It is hopefully the beginning of stopping their rule over our food and their poison that they're giving us.
In this guerrilla gardening action, are you focusing on, you know, planting food crops or other types of plants?
We're planting trees, herbs, and food because all of life is being exploited by the corporate world right now, and that has to change. What has been structured in this week of actions is a tree canvas that goes on. We have saplings that are going out to neighbors, to neighborhoods all over the city to see if people would like a tree or people would take care of a tree that's planted for them. There's also what we did this morning, which is we went to an organic farm in the city and we helped them. They need help. They have a 2-acre plot and they don't have enough people. We went there with a crew of about 12 and helped them out. Really building good community support. People in the community are really into this action. People are really into what it stands for. We don't want it to be stepping on the people in this community's toes. We are here to show the corporate world, to show the IMF, the World Bank, that we're pissed, that we aren't, but we also are not trying to hurt what's going on here in D.C. already. It's just much bigger than that, but working with the community has been amazing so far.
Now, are you yourself from here, or, where do you live? What kind of community is it? Do you live in a city? Do you live in a rural area?
Well, for the past few years, I've been living in a city, and our community had set up quite a few gardens there. Recently, I've been in a rural area on a farm, kind of back, learning more.
Do you have any idea how much land would it take for a family of four to take care of most of its fresh vegetable needs if they were growing their own food?
Roughly a half acre. If it's an extremely easy thing to do, 1 acre could feed a half a neighborhood.
What kind of response have you had from the police and other similar authorities so far in terms of your guerrilla gardening action?
Well, so far, nothing has been done illegally. Nothing. We were just working with the community gardeners, which is our more main focus is really working on, for right now, is working with community gardeners. And we haven't had any interactions with the police yet.
Do you think that might happen?
I do.
What about people that have no experience in gardening before? Will they learn?
With a group of people doing it in a communal way, you don't need to have too much experience. There's people here that do have experience, and planting is a very wonderful and basic thing.
How have you gotten your materials? Have they been donated? Have you been starting seedlings and bringing them in anticipation of the action, or what?
We've had seedlings going. We have gotten donations. We really don't have much. We've been putting it out for the last few months in our organizing that affinity groups should come with their own tools and their own things, just for the fact that we can't supply that. There's going to be too many people here. There's going to be too many things going on. We will take everything that we can to plant, and that's like, it's all on donations. It's totally grassroots. We haven't spent a dollar. We don't have a dollar.
Is there anything that you'd more that you'd like to say, about this particular action or about any larger issues that you feel connect to this?
Well, I feel this connects to the biggest issue, which is corporate control of the world. Agriculture is really their strong point in my eyes, because food is something that everyone needs. Though capitalism can fall and people will go on with no food, they won't go on. So we have to really take our food back. We have to control. We have to reclaim our food, so they don't have control over it forever.
This is a protest. You can protest the bad, it is, the things that you don't like, the things that are not positive. But at the same time, you can work on demonstrating what the alternatives are to that. And that's kind of how I look at this. Is this something that everybody involved in the action is kind of one vision on?
Well, yeah, we do share that vision. And really, this started working after what happened in Seattle and the image that people, especially anarchists, got in Seattle. Because anarchists are not just about breaking windows, though it is something that needs to happen. And it cannot be condemned because it does need to happen, but we also are here to show that we want to bring life back to this earth. And here, with the way things are set up, we need to keep organizing. We need to keep people into us, and negative images are something that we don't need, and we are not about. It is not a negative thing. This is a very positive and very well thought out vision that anarchists that I've talked to have. And instead of breaking windows in D.C., we'll be breaking ground.
Have you been involved at all with some of the community gardens movements that are in places like New York City?
Not too much in New York City. I have been involved in some through the Midwest, in Minnesota and Chicago and just helping out. I haven't really organized much throughout that. I've gotten a lot of ideas from things like that. We've set up a few. We just started last year setting up rooftop gardens in Chicago, which was for Food Not Bombs. They were Food Not Bombs gardens that were grown by the people who worked with Food Not Bombs, and then distributed throughout the community.
One of the things that occurs to me, and you know, in a lot of places, is you're dealing with a winter situation where there's no growing happening. Have you been giving thoughts to greenhouses or what other alternatives that people might deal with if they were going to say, okay, we're going to try to give ourselves our food needs here, we're going to get organized in our community, get our gardening going, but what do we do in the winter? What do we do in the winter in Minnesota?
Well, to tell you, in Minnesota, we have started something which we feel is a great step and something that will work by dumpstering windows. Windows from buildings are thrown out all over the place. We have been putting them together, constructing them into greenhouses, which you can put with wood stoves and heat them and grow throughout the winter. It's a tricky thing, especially in Minnesota, but it can be done. And we are in testing of it right now. We didn't do it last winter. Just starting this action is just a beginning. Well, to be honest with you, it's going to be happening for May Day in other countries. There's guerrilla gardening actions that are happening in London and all other places. And a few other places, but it's like this is the beginning of something really big. And if it was available on the web, it could be even bigger, because there's cities all over this country that need gardens all over the place. And if we can help motivate people, that's what we're here for.
Well, I mean, the reason why I say this is, of course, I'm sure you know that gardeners in New York City are actually facing brutal treatment. You know, gardens have been beaten, forcibly bulldozed, and all of that kind of stuff, which is something I think that surprises people. Are people discussing, how to deal with those aspects when you have a situation where the garden is seen as a terrible threat to the established powers?
Well, I think we have to. I mean, it's obviously sounds great, ridiculous,
yeah,
and there's nothing we can do except for roll with their punches and play their game, and it's like any other resistance. It's just we do what we feel is right, and if they come and bring us down, we're just going to come back stronger every time. And sooner or later, they have to realize that growing food is not a violent or intimidating thing to any part of their social structure except for their money.
You know, I would say it definitely intimidates their concepts of private property.
Their wasted private property that sits there for 20 years as a vacant lot, even though they own it, is waste. And we don't. I personally have no respect for private property in that way, in wasted private property, because there is too many things that can be done with it for communities and to keep communities strong, which is the basis of this country when it was taken over.
You were with the Minnehaha Free State as well, and you worked with the Mendota people there.
Yeah,
I did. Yes.
What did you learn from them in terms of their concepts of, you know, property, gardening, community, all of these things? You know, what kind of cultural exchange happened with the, you know, like the activists who, you know, let's call it the Earth First and other, you know, American, let's say, activists, and the Mendota people?
Well, that was just an amazing thing. They've lived their lives through community. And it's not really a new concept to them, even though as like white activists or whatever, community is really a new thing, because it's something that we weren't brought up, most of us, because we were brought up by the TV, and that doesn't teach you community. It doesn't, and that was just an amazing thing, because it's like it's not a new concept to them, so it's just a part of their life. And it's in seeing that, you see how basic those things are and how well they work.
You mentioned growing up with TV. At, you know, what point in your growing up process did you determine that there was something wrong about the way things were? How did that happen for you?
Did you remember?
I do. It was a long, slow process. It really was, because I didn't have an influence. To be honest, I grew up in a suburb, and I had no alternative insight by any means. I was on Grateful Dead tour, and that got me into a communal way. And that really started turning me on to things, and then just slowly I grew up in a city that was big enough to where I saw demonstrations happening, and soon enough got to plug in, but it was my own, it was me doing it myself, and it was really hard, and it took me a long time. I would have been in it much sooner if I had that opportunity. And that I fear with a lot of people that would be into the resistance and into the revolution if they weren't stuck in their suburbs, if they weren't totally, like, sheltered. And that is something that I really try to focus on, going through and trying to talk to people that wouldn't usually get talked to, and not just going to the cities, but trying to go to the suburbs somewhat and things like that.
How receptive do you find that people are? I mean, what do you say to kind of break the ice?
with gardening in specific, it's such a basic thing. It's like, would you like food? Would you like to grow your own food so you don't have to buy food? And right there, people are turned on to it. People are, in any context, it's like, in any situation that they're into not spending more money if they don't have to. And though that's not the only reason, it's just a way to really get people into it. So, I mean, I've gotten very positive feedback on helping. I've set up 4 gardens this year in different places on my trek out here, and just help people with their gardens and help set up new ones in Philly and stuff. And it's cool. I mean, people dig it.
Corporate control of the media was also on the agenda. A long battle of civil disobedience and lawsuits has been waged by community radio activists to take back the airwaves. The Federal Communications Commission agreed last year to license low-power FM radio, but even that was too much for the commercial broadcast lobby, the National Association of Broadcasters, the NAB, one of the most powerful lobbies in America. 2 of the NAB's congressional representatives, Oxley and Dingell, sponsored a bill with the Orwellian title, The Preservation of Broadcasting Act, which would kill low-power community radio. This passed the House of Representatives on April 13th, and will move to a vote in the Senate soon. The Mount Pleasant Broadcasting Club, a local community group hoping to get a radio license for their D.C. neighborhood, protested in front of NAB headquarters with their mouths taped shut. Several burly security guards stood blocking off the entrance to the NAB's concrete and glass edifice near DuPont Circle.
The rattles that you hear are symbolic of our own voices being silenced, not having access to our own public airwaves as a nonprofit community group. So the rattles are, our voices are silent, but we can still make noise.
And we are here today at the National Association of Broadcasters, and this private property, no trespassing, is a perfect symbol of what the National Association of Broadcasters is trying to do to communities and citizens, trying to keep communities and citizens off the airwaves and try to keep it totally for corporations that have millions of dollars and are motivated only by profit. We have been working for years to start a community radio station in Washington, D.C. that serves a diverse neighborhood in Ward 1, and we are today presenting this award to the National Association of Broadcasters, the Bad Neighbor Award. We are also going to present a similar award to National Public Radio, who claims to be pro-community and pro-community radio, yet has come out against micropower radio.
Several days later, on April 17th, another micro radio station, Mobilization Radio, a collaborative effort set up just for the protests, was raided by the police and freed by the people. Rhizome from Free Radio Santa Cruz reported on the rescue of Mobilization Radio.
Started out very tense when we got a call at the Independent Media Center in D.C., that the FCC was knocking on the door of the low-power FM station, Mobilization Radio 97.5, and we proceeded to the event to cover it and document what was going on. When we got there, there was only one guy out there who was apparently the FCC agent, and an older guy in a yellow rain jacket, and he immediately went inside, and we started asking people what was up, and eventually more police came, and then a few more activists and media people came, and then a lot more police came, and they blocked off the building and put a police line up, and we were able to gather at that point that from the officer in charge that, in fact, they did not have a search warrant, and that they didn't even know what was going on in there, the police, that is.
Right, so they had armed...
a low-power radio station, and they were kind of in disbelief that all this had happened, and then suddenly... And then, at that point, someone had made a call to the mobilization folks, and about 200 or 300 people, some reports say 400, marched down the street with puppets chanting and drums and everything, and confronted the police, basically, and demanded that they leave within 5 minutes.
Really?
The police,
within 5 minutes?
Situation, were forced to say, okay, we're leaving, give us 5 minutes. And we cleared the streets and went to the sidewalk, and they left within 30 seconds, both the FBI, the Metropolitan Police, and the FCC. And the broadcasters that were in there were released from the building by the activists and shuttled off somewhere, and apparently the equipment was saved.
Global capitalism doesn't just destroy the lives of people in far-off countries. We'll conclude with a story that makes a connection and brings it all home to the nation's capital.
Thousands of people reclaimed the streets and the media while protesting the very existence of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank during the mobilization for global justice in Washington, D.C., April 16th and 17th. Through rallies, marches, teach-ins, puppets, banners, and direct action, they managed to start a discussion on economic, environmental, social, and health impact of irresponsible corporate power. Within a coalition of youth, students, labor, indigenous people, international activists, and Washingtonians, they were confronted by barricades, police in riot gear, gas masks, pepper spray, and tear gas. At such a standoff on 20th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, I met a Washingtonian couple who brought the issue home.
Me and my wife, we represent the homeless action here in D.C. This is typical not just of Washington police, but it's typical of Gestapo practices in this country, period. Let those be the perpetrators and not us. Let us do our job. On this side of the barricade, our job is to make sure that WTO, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and the IMF, the World Money Fund, know that we are tired of their practices and their policies on poor and disadvantaged people all over the world. The reaction has to come from the people in this country. The ones that's sitting down and looking at the 6 o'clock news, they have to become motivated and activated in order to bring about the change. See, we're not just here to be hanging out. We come down with a representation of a group of people who are poor and disadvantaged. I myself am homeless. She's homeless. We sleep in front of a church that just told us we had to move off the property. We're being evicted from a church. On top of all of that, we're here because there is no national health care. I suffered from cancer. I have terminal cancer. They gave me 6 months to live. But I can't get treatment because I don't have the money to go get the type of treatment that I need. This is all part of this capitalistic situation that we're living in. I did have some food, but it got missing, so now I'm hungry again. We're here to say that this just can't happen on Monday. It has to happen Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It has to be like the civil rights movement of the old. It has to happen every day. We have to clog the streets up. We have to clog this area up every day in order to bring about a change. This one day or this 2 days or this last week will not bring about the change, because this gentleman will go back to Harvard, you'll go back to your country, and then it'll go back to business as usual. People will sit down and they'll look at this like we sit down and look at the Vietnam War. We look at tapes of it and things of this nature, and nothing changes.
Justice is in the hands of the people. My name is Iris Arafa. This person started the homeless newspaper, Life on the Line, Life on the Great, which is not getting any support from the homeless advocates right here at the local level. So we can't even take a trip around the world to join in solidarity with other organizations, because we can barely feed ourselves working with our own hands. So the advocates are our worst enemies. So that's the equivalent of the WTO against the little people around the world. So where do we go from here? How do we get this group right here to begin to support the fact that we need to eat right now at this moment that we speak? If we can deal with that and then begin to convert these feeding holes to non-profit restaurants, what can grow out of that? Then we can spur in a whole lot of positive development at the same time that you're putting pressure on this, so we can accomplish two things at once. And I think that's the agenda that needs to go forth. If the people know to stop talking to the police, stop talking to the WTO and talk to each other. What did the WTO establish? A world center. If we all direct our resources to obtain that, CCNV, the biggest shelter in the country, place, which is one block from the mayor's office, two blocks from the nation's capital, we can begin to build. At the same time that they're making a statement by being here, we can find out who's got sewing machines and fabric and put 1,500 people to work, and we can start making our own garments. Stop buying from the oppressed. Deal directly. Let's boycott McDonald's. Let's boycott Burger King. Let's boycott Pepsi Cola.
Gap.
And stop buying. Y'all young people buy clothes. Y'all buy stuff. Stop buying, and let's start redirecting those resources. You can join with people and start enterprise. Get the people in prison to start making their own uniforms. Everybody has ideas and areas in which to focus. Let's begin to do that. Go back to your hometown and reach out to the mayor and to the city council and put the pressure on them, and especially Ellen Holmes Norton right here in Washington, D.C. I'm running against her as a delegate to the House of Representatives because she doesn't even talk to homeless people. But they always want to have a breakfast for the homeless once a year, and the homeless don't even get a chance to speak.
You have just listened to a Washingtonian homeless couple who are among the coalition of protesters against the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and corporate greed. I'm Reem Kathuda from the Independent Media Center in Washington, D.C.
All of the material in today's program was produced by reporters and activists from the Independent Media Center. Thanks. If you want to see what democracy and police brutality look like on April 16th, check out the website at www.indymedia.org, IndyMedia.org. If you wish you were there, cheer up. The struggle continues.
Oh, the cops are chasing people through the park and are starting to shoot off pepper spray. Lots of people are retreating through the park, spray, and now the police are putting on their full masks. They're basically pushing all the protesters back across Caddy Corner, across the park. They're chasing after people. I see them hitting people with the baton. General melee.
Probably one thing we did show, there are a variety of tactics, all of them nonviolent, which can be used in a demonstration. And we can take back the streets, we can occupy, we can push through.
Good horse, as we trot in this dark here, robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by a